I'm Jason Van Medding.
And I'm Ksenia Chmutina.
Welcome to Disasters Deconstructed Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back for another episode of Disasters Deconstructed Podcast. So this week, we're going to talk about disaster myths. How exciting. Hi, Jason.
Hey, Ksenia. We've been talking about some different aspects of, you know, how disasters are created, as well connecting to some of these dominant narratives that the status quo is kind of built on, whether they be social, political, or economic, and how tightly controlled those narratives are, and indeed what the impact of that is, and how the powerful avoid scrutiny and criticism. And a lot of times these narratives are constructed around myths and tropes about disasters. So, like, as we've been discussing, this whole season, the first season of Disasters Deconstructed, is devoted to this natural disaster expression and that idea. And hopefully by the end of the season, we will leave you in no doubt that disasters are social constructs and that understanding them as natural is problematic.
Indeed. And, you know, this is one of the myths, I guess, so many scholars have been discussing over the years. But it's still, this natural disasters idea is still part of the public consciousness. And I don't know if many of you have seen, but recently on Twitter, there's been quite a lot of exciting stuff coming from the blog post from David Alexander, who started to write or, you know, collect different disaster myths. And top three, it seems, coming to irrational antisocial behavior, helpless status of victims, and also unreliable emergency services. So that's what people believe happen in and after disasters. But does it?
Indeed. So joining us today to discuss disaster myths, we're so privileged to have Dr. Samantha Montano, who you may know from her amazing communication efforts about emergency management, disasters, risk, and climate change. Her handle on Twitter is Sam L. Montano. Thanks for being with us, Samantha.
Thanks for having me.
So excited to talk to you.
Hi, Samantha. It's absolutely amazing to have you here. You're just so prolific on Twitter. You know, in your bio, you're calling yourself a disasterologist. You know, how do you become one? What does it mean?
Sure. So I get asked this a lot. So the way I define disasterologist is simply someone who studies disasters. I'm not super interested in gatekeeping, so I think anybody who is doing that can call themselves a disasterologist. The term itself has been used by disaster scholars in the past as part of a kind of a bigger argument about whether disaster studies is becoming a discipline itself or not. But that's a separate conversation. I'm just really using it as kind of an easy way to describe for the public what it is I do.
It's brilliant. So what do you think people think you do when they hear that you're a disasterologist?
Well, that's actually how I started using the word disasterologist. Is when I was in grad school, people would ask me what I did, and I would say I'm an emergency management researcher, and you could just see the look of confusion come over them. And they would be like, "Are you a firefighter?" And I'm like, no. And so I started using the word disasterologist to kind of help them clarify. And so now when I introduce myself as a disasterologist, you see that like immediate recognition of, oh, you study disasters. That's so cool. And so, yeah, it's really become an easier way to kind of have them understand more broadly what I do.
That's brilliant.
Very cool. So it sounds like, Ksenia, you and I might even be able to use that term at some point, right?
Disaster. Is there like the World Disasterologist Day?
No, not that I know of, but there should be.
That's a good
idea. We need to introduce one, right? So there you go.
That's amazing. I love it. Yeah.
So So Samantha, I saw you wrote this article for the Washington Post recently titled Five Myths About Floods. And in it, you said that dangerous myths persist and shape how we prepare and respond to floods. So can you tell us about some of these myths and why you argue that they're actually dangerous?
Sure. So when you, within the disaster research world, when we say the disaster myths, most of us are referring, I think, to like a very specific list of myths that came from researchers at the Disaster Research Center and starting in like the 1970s that are all related to human behavior. So myths that persist about how people react to disasters. So that's like the one set of myths that we have. But then there's also this like whole other group of things that are going on that are just like general misunderstandings or misperceptions. I guess some of them maybe you would call a myth. Things like that disasters are natural, that disasters don't discriminate. All of these kind of little like catchphrases that we hear pretty frequently within the like broader disaster narrative. And so for the Washington Post, they specifically asked me to write about some myths and misunderstandings about flooding. And so I, it was hard to narrow it down to only five, but I can maybe walk through one or two of them if that's useful.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay. So one of our major myths that we have about flooding is that is related to homeowners insurance. So in the United States, homeowners insurance that everybody has for their house doesn't cover flood damage, which is a really big problem given the increasing number of people that are experiencing floods across the country. Unfortunately, you always hear after a major flood happens, survivors talking about how they just assumed that flood damage would be covered under homeowners insurance, and then they come to find out it's not, and they get thrown into this recovery system, which in the U.S. is just kind of a nightmare to go through. FEMA does not just go around writing checks out to people. You get very little money from the government to rebuild. You are then reliant on your savings or your family or friends to help you. But of course, if you're rebuilding an entire house, that, you know, the resources you can kind of scrape together don't necessarily cover all of your damages. And so people get thrown into this really just awful kind of cycle of recovery that can last for many, many years. And so to answer kind of the second part of your question, the reason I would argue that something like that misunderstanding about flood insurance is so dangerous is because we have other research that tells us that it's during the recovery process where we can see some really negative mental and physical health impacts. So we see higher rates of suicide, increases in domestic violence, and just like general stress and depression increase overall throughout this recovery process. And so for a family that doesn't have flood insurance, you start to see how that can lead you down like many years of trying to figure out recovery and start to see some of these negative health impacts increase. So that's one example of how this like what is ultimately like seems like something that could be pretty easy to fix and like letting people know that they need flood insurance can kind of like just escalate into this much bigger problem for recovery.
So Samantha, is there anyone doing research to sort of collect empirical data to demonstrate the impact of myths that you know of?
No, not that I know of. I'm sure there is somebody out there doing it, but not that I know of. This is one of those areas where we could really be making a really big difference, I think, out in the world if we were able to study this a bit better. That's another thing about these myths. I mentioned those human behavior myths from the 1970s. We are like pretty, that's within the field of disaster research, that research about myths is like we're pretty secure on that. Like we're really confident in those findings, more so than other things in disaster research. But since, you know, a lot of those initial studies, there have been some efforts to do further research, but it really hasn't been a huge focus for many researchers. Yeah. And I think that there are a lot of really important questions that we need to be asking, and those, like understanding those myths about human behavior gives us a really, really, really good foundation, but we haven't really taken it that next step to actually empirically look at what the implications of those myths are, and even to look at what the actual prevalence of those myths continues to be. There's been kind of a couple studies here and there that have looked at how certain people understand those myths, but we don't have like a good data set on that.
So where do these myths come from? You know, what kind of, who starts them, and why, I guess, why do people fall for them?
The kind of prevailing assumption seems to be among disaster researchers that I've seen is that these myths are perpetuated by like Hollywood disaster movies and by media coverage of events. And I mean, it's kind of understandable, right? If you've never been through a disaster before and you have seen a few disaster movies and you watch the news when they cover a disaster, then sure, of course, you're going to think that's what happens during a disaster. It's pretty understandable. Mm. I think there is definitely a lot that I think we can do to break this spell. One of the things that I spend a lot of time being concerned about is how often I interact with an emergency manager who believes one of these myths. And that is, I think, I'm much more concerned about a practitioner or a politician or somebody who has like some kind of power within emergency management who believes one of these myths, as opposed to just like Joe Schmo, like out in the middle of California, whatever. You know, it's really much more about how somebody understanding these myths has an implication on the way we're responding or preparing or recovering from a disaster. That's where I think the like biggest concern is.
How do you think that would impact the practice of emergency managers, for instance?
Yeah, so again, we need more research here, but there are some stories that we hear of emergency managers who are hesitant to send out warnings because they're worried about causing mass panic. So that would be an example of where something we know from the research, this practitioner does not know, and then they're making a decision that is ultimately uninformed that could have a tangible impact on people's lives. And again, if we had better research here, I'm positive we would find examples where this has happened.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about research, that research can actually help us prove, right, that these myths are not correct. But what if by doing this research, you would actually upset somebody else's truth, you know, in quotation mark, truth, this kind of somebody else's power or somebody else's, you know, decades of research? How do you fight that?
I mean, well, that's the beauty of research, is that sometimes old findings are found to no longer be true or whatnot. I think that's why studying the prevalence of these myths are so important, right? It really matters how many emergency managers believe that people panic during disasters, right? It does matter if the general public believes it, right? To the extent that these myths may portray survivors as kind of being helpless or dehumanizing them in any way, and how that may be tied to decisions to donate or decisions to volunteer, right? So I'm not saying it's not important for the general public to understand these as myths also, but I think there's like a more direct and like an immediate concern when it comes to practitioners and other people in positions of power that are understanding these myths.
Sure.
Again, in the U.S., most of our emergency managers are coming from a military or first responder background. So again, this command and control type approach to emergency management. And, you know, a lot of these human behavior myths, like looting is a good example. I mean, that term even comes out of wartime. And so, you know, you can see the transition of that kind of belief and interpretation of human behavior onto civilian life. And I think another way to like kind of connect this is in looking at how some practitioners, and again, not all practitioners here, but some practitioners are kind of hesitant to embrace spontaneous volunteers or embrace grassroots organizations that are looking to help during the response and recovery because of kind of persistent misunderstandings about what spontaneous volunteers in these organizations are trying to do for a community. So I think it's kind of like a similar thing. And, you know, to their credit, FEMA has been working towards their whole community approach, and how that manifests in reality is another conversation. But I definitely see that there is starting to be a bit of a shift among practitioners in terms of these things. And I think part of that is also as we see more practitioners entering the field that actually have a degree in emergency management and have kind of gone through programs that are teaching them about these myths and having these conversations with them before they even enter the field. Hopefully we'll see some shifting there.
So you, I know, have done a lot of work on volunteering. So like, what are some of the most interesting things that you've learned in your research?
Yeah, so there is kind of we talk about like the myths of disaster volunteering. They're just myths everywhere. There's kind of this belief that, you know, volunteers are going to show up and everybody's worried about liability issues, and they're worried about volunteers not being trained, and they're worried about volunteers kind of overwhelming the community. And like, certainly those are all things we need to be aware about and like keep an eye on. But ultimately, there is extremely little evidence to support that volunteers are getting severely injured while helping, or that they're causing more of a problem than they are contributing. Like, overwhelmingly, the research has found that they are more of a help than a hindrance. And so, you know, spontaneous volunteers can kind of get a bad rap, but they're fundamental to the response. Like, they're saving lives. It, you know, it's great to say that we want everybody who's doing search and rescue to have training. Like, yeah, sure, that is the ideal. But the reality of the situation is that that's never going to happen. There aren't enough people who are trained who can get into a community to do search and rescue in time. Like, we're on the clock with that kind of thing. And so you need spontaneous volunteers. And I also think it's, you know, pretty ridiculous to say you can't go help your neighbors during a disaster.
Who then creates these stories, you know, and why? What's the benefit of creating this untruth?
Well, I think some of it comes from this kind of like us versus them, insiders versus outsiders perspective. I think that especially when you have like a pretty small, close-knit community and a disaster happens, you know, that community has been traumatized. And then to see this like outpouring of people coming from surrounding communities can, I imagine, feel very overwhelming. Mm-hmm. You know, on the one hand, it's like, oh, the cavalry is here to help. But on the other, it's like, who are these people? Like, we don't know you. Like, when you're coming into a small, close-knit community, that like perception of having outsiders come in can be, you know, difficult to process.
Right.
So in all of this, we've been talking about the role of the media does seem to be central, because we're talking about narratives and why people believe things and why they perceive things the way that they do. Samantha, you said that it's not always only the media or films, and there's deeper kind of, you know, social narratives and beliefs about who we are and our values and our identity. And I think that's kind of linked to the socioeconomic system that we live within, right? So we've been talking, Ksenia and I, about the idea of our second season, kind of focusing on this idea of storytelling and narratives and film and art, right? So, like, who do you think these storytellers are that have some responsibility to convey these messages? And why, like, why do some of these amazing storytellers continue to spread myths?
Well, so I like to separate out, like, journalists from Hollywood here. I think that, you know, storytellers in Hollywood are interested in, like, telling this, like, white male narrative when they talk about disaster movies. And, like, you know, they're looking for wartime hero, like, overcoming this great feat and, like, helping all of these helpless people around them. I think that's, like, pretty clearly the overarching disaster narrative there. And I think that given the lack of diversity generally in Hollywood, that narrative has been allowed to continue over many, many decades. Perhaps there will be a shift as we see changes in diversity in Hollywood. I don't know. I also, though, am not always sure what Hollywood's responsibility is here. I mean, most of these disaster stories they're telling are fiction. And so I don't know. It's interesting for disasterologists to go say, well, this wouldn't happen, this wouldn't happen, that's not accurate, you know, and do kind of a movie with a disasterologist type thing. But ultimately, they're writing their own stories. And if that's the narrative they want to write, I think we can push back on that by not going to see those movies or, you know, whatever. But, you know, I don't think they're doing it necessarily in, like, an overtly malicious way. I don't think they're out there saying, ah, we're going to go perpetuate the disaster myths today or anything like that. But I think just, like, as part of a broader conversation about how we need to be able to hear more people's voices in the stories that we tell and the stories that we see, that's true among disaster movies as well. In terms of media and journalism specifically, I think that there is kind of this more generous explanation for why they have perpetuated these myths. And I think that is that they just don't know. I know that it feels like from a disaster researcher perspective that all we ever talk about are these disaster myths. Like sometimes I'm like, if I have to say people do not panic during disasters one more time, I'm going to lose it. But we have to remember that, you know, a lot of journalists that are covering disasters have never covered a disaster before. They don't have a background in emergency management. They are just observing the scene and writing what they're saying, and they're kind of mimicking what they've grown up hearing also in the media. And so, you know, I also, this is maybe like a more concrete example. There are very often you'll be watching CNN after a disaster happens and you'll see a reporter interviewing a survivor of a tornado that has just happened. And the the reporter will say, tell me what happened. And the person will say, oh, well, I heard the tornado siren and I panicked. And so I grabbed my kids and we went to the storm shelter. And when the journalist goes to report on this conversation, they say, oh, everyone was panicked, because that's what she said. But as a disaster researcher listening to what she said, I hear that she heard a warning. She took in this information. She went and grabbed her kids, demonstrating this pro-social behavior that we're talking about. And then she took an appropriate action given the information she had. She got in a storm shelter. She did exactly what we would expect somebody in her situation to do. But in her retelling of that, she used that word panic, not in the way that sociologists in the 1970s were using the term panic, but in the like colloquial way that we all use it of like, oh, I can't find my keys, I'm panicking. You know, I'm not actually panicking. I'm just upset because I can't find my keys, right? But of course, when journalists then go to reprint the headline of the day, it's everyone panicked as this tornado happened. And so I think that's kind of the like more generous explanation of it. Just there's a confusion in terms and kind of how we're interpreting that. And then I think the like less generous explanation is that, you know, these myths serve to dehumanize and depower local communities. And I think you can start heading into some like shock doctrine, disaster capitalism territory. And you can look at the way that communities of color are discussed post-disaster versus white affluent communities post-disaster. And you can see the, how socioeconomic differences and patriarchy and white supremacy and race, class, and gender all like are intertwined throughout all of this in various ways. And I think that's obviously the much more complicated part to pull away, especially when we're dealing with relatively little recent empirical research.
So I guess very often the narratives are shaped for those who would listen to those narratives, right? You know, the news are reported for a certain audience. That's why we have different channels and kind of different newspapers. And thus they show what the audience is expecting them to show. And yet some narratives are not told at all. You know, the, I mean, how much coverage did we have of the Storm Aida a couple of weeks ago? You know, in the UK, there wasn't much. It was kind of mentioned, but that's about it. So what should we do about it? You know, can we do something about it? Can we shape narratives differently? Should we engage with media? I don't know. What's the silver bullet?
Well, I don't know if it's a silver bullet, but I kind of found myself a couple years ago, literally just like on Twitter, yelling at journalists every time they wrote an article about disasters, being like, what are you talking about? None of this is true. And it took a while, and I got to know a couple of these journalists, which like, bless their hearts for putting up with me. But I started talking to them, and I started understanding more of like, oh, they have no disaster background. Like their editor was just like, oh, go report on this wildfire. Like they have no background in any of this. And they're not, we don't even have really very few people are actually on like a disaster beat. Like they are just jumping around from different things. And so they don't even over the course of a career necessarily like build up that knowledge. And so once I understood that more, I started reflecting on what it was that I could do to like try to, justify or like try to like help this situation. And that is when I started writing more for popular media outlets and kind of like breaking out of research to do more of that science communication stuff. And once I started doing that and I was looking around, I realized that especially in the US, there are very, very few disaster researchers that are doing this. There's very few like scientists and researchers in general that are doing this type of thing. I guess maybe it's becoming a little bit more common, but it is really difficult to do. And so I understand why more researchers don't do it. It's also not, you know, rewarded or prioritized if you're trying to get tenure or anything like that. So there's like some structural barriers to more disaster researchers like speaking to the public directly. But in emergency management, I use this example kind of a lot, but to the extent that we focused on bringing emergency management research out into the world, we have focused on connecting with emergency management practitioners, which is very logical. But we also know that the majority of work that is done related to emergency management and disasters is not done by people in the profession of emergency management. It's done by people in nonprofits and in businesses and in other parts of government and just regular people and media. And we have done very little to communicate with all those other parts of the world that are the people that are writing these narratives and writing these stories. It's not emergency managers who are like driving that narrative, really. It's people from all other parts of life. And so that's the part that I've tried to focus on more. I still work with people in the profession as well, but I've tried to like branch out and push into those other areas. Even the past 2 years, seeing how climate change has started to be woven into the stories of individual disasters that have happened. And I don't think the way we're talk or the media is talking about climate change in relationship to each of those disasters is like complete or necessarily the right framing. But I think the fact that they're even kind of like drawing a line between multiple disasters that are happening and starting to kind of like make like connection for the public, it's something different to me as I look at that from what I've seen in the past. And I am probably a little too optimistic about the potential for what journalism as related to disasters could look like in the future.
I just wonder whether this is going to change, because we see like now in the last couple of years, there's a huge shift in sort of dystopian fiction, you know, where all of a sudden we talk about climate change. I mean, you know, Margaret Atwood has been talking about it for a while, but like even Richard Powers now, you know, and many other authors. So I'm kind of quite optimistic that actually the storytelling will shift.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely will shift. I guess the question is just, in what way will it shift? And will it be more or less useful for us?
Right.
This has been so fascinating, Samantha. Thanks for dropping in with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Samantha.
Really excited to share this episode with our listeners.
As always, the podcast is available wherever you're getting your podcast, and the next episode will come next Monday. So hopefully you're enjoying listening to us, and follow us on Twitter at DisastersDecon and also on Instagram.
You have been listening to Ksenia, Jason, and me, Samantha, on Disasters Deconstructed podcast.